Chapter 7. Understanding the Future. Between Apocalypse and Singularity. Apocalypse comes via Latin from the ancient Greek apokalypsis. Literally, it means uncovering. In the Christian context, the meaning shifted toward a prophesied unveiling or revelation of the second coming. And in modern usage, the term has become synonymous with the end of life on earth, the doomsday, or, to use another Greek biblical term, Armageddon. Clear and unambiguously definitive. Apocalyptic visions of the future, with assorted hells offered by major religions, have been strongly revived by modern promoters of doom, who have been pointing to rapid population growth, environmental pollution, or now, increasingly, to global warming as the sins that will transport us to the netherworld. In contrast, incorrigible techno-optimists continue the tradition of believing in miracles and the delivery of eternal salvation. It is not uncommon to read how artificial intelligence and deep learning systems will carry us all the way to the singularity. This comes from the Latin singularis, meaning individual, unique, unmatched. But in this chapter, it refers to futurist Ray Kurzweil's notion of singularity, i.e. to the mathematical meaning of the term as a point in time at which a function assumes an infinite value. He predicts that, come 2045, machine intelligence will have surpassed human intelligence, what he calls biological and non-biological intelligence will merge, and machine intelligence will fill the universe at infinite speed. This is the ultimate ascension. Colonization of the rest of the universe, an inevitably effortless endeavor. Long-range modeling of complex systems often relies on producing a fan of possible outcomes constrained by plausible extremes. Apocalypse and singularity offer two absolutes. Our future will have to lie somewhere within that all-encompassing range. What has been so remarkable about modern anticipations of the future is how they have gravitated, despite all of the available evidence, toward one of these two extremes. In the past, this tendency toward dichotomy was often described as the clash of catastrophists and cornucopians, but these labels appear to be too timid to reflect the recent extreme polarization of sentiments. And this polarization has been accompanied by a greater propensity for dated quantitative forecasts. You see them everywhere. From cars, worldwide sales of electric passenger vehicles will reach 56 million by 2040. And carbon. The EU will have net zero carbon emissions by 2050. To global flying. There will be 8.2 billion travellers by 2037. Or so we're told. In reality, most of these forecasts are no better than simple guesses. Any number for 2050 obtained by a computer model, primed with dubious assumptions, or even worse, by a politically expedient decision, has a very brief shelf life. My advice, if you would like a better understanding of what the future may look like, avoid these New Age dated prophecies entirely, or use them primarily as evidence of prevailing expectations and biases. For generations, businesses and governments were the most common practitioners and consumers of forecasting. Then academics joined the game in large numbers from the 1950s. And now anybody can be a forecaster, even without any mathematical skills, simply by using plug-in software or, as has been in vogue lately, by making baseless qualitative predictions. As in so many other cases of newly expanded endeavors, information flows, mass education, the quantity of modern forecasting has become inversely proportional to its quality. Many forecasts are nothing but the simplest extensions of past trajectories. Others are the outcome of complicated interactive models which incorporate large numbers of variables and run using different assumptions each time, essentially the numerical equivalent of narrative scenarios, and some have hardly any quantitative component and are just wishful and exceedingly politically correct narratives. Quantitative forecasts fall into three broad categories. The smallest includes forecasts that deal with processes whose workings are well known and whose dynamics are inherently restricted to a relatively confined set of outcomes. The second, a much larger category, includes forecasts pointing in the right direction but with substantial uncertainties regarding the specific outcome. And the third category, I already described some of its recent energy and environmental specimens in the previous chapter, is that of quantitative fables. Such forecasting exercises may teem with numbers, but the numbers are outcomes of layered and often questionable assumptions, and the processes traced by such computerized fairy tales will have very different real-world endings. Of course, their creators may defend the heuristic value of such exercises, while uninitiated users may exploit some of the conclusions to reinforce their own prejudices or to dismiss plausible alternatives. Only the forecasts, projections, computer models in the first category provide solid insights and good guidance, especially when looking only a decade or so ahead. Demographic projections in general and fertility forecasts in particular are among the best examples in this limited category. Take a country whose total fertility rate, that is, the number of children the average woman has in her lifetime, has been below the replacement level. An average of at least 2.1 children per woman is needed to replace the parents for a generation, and moreover, retreated from 1.8 to 1.5 over the past decade. Such very low fertilities are unlikely to be reversed. No country has done so during the past three decades to bring any substantial population increase within the next 10 years. The most likely prospects are fertility that may recover a bit, from 1.5 to 1.7, or drop further to 1.3. While it is impossible to pinpoint the value even in just 10 years, a forecast can offer a relatively narrow range of highly plausible outcomes. For example, the UN's 2019 population forecast for the year 2030 has Poland's total, 37.9 million in 2020, declining to 36.9 million, with the low and high variant departing just plus or minus 2% from the mean. And, barring mass immigration that is unlikely in such an immigration-averse country, there is a very high probability that the actual 2030 count will be within that narrow range. In contrast, even short-term projections involving complex systems, those that reflect interplays of many technical, economic, and environmental factors, and which can be strongly affected by a number of arbitrary decisions such as unexpectedly generous government subsidies or new laws or sudden policy reversals, remain highly uncertain. And even near-term outlooks result in a broad range of possible outcomes. Forecasts for the worldwide adoption of electric passenger cars are an excellent recent example in this category. Technical difficulties accompanying the introduction of personal electromobility have not been insurmountable, but the sector has been maturing much slower than its uncritical proponents began to claim years ago, while combustion engines keep improving their efficiency and will offer for years to come the advantages of lower initial cost, generations-long familiarity, and ubiquitous servicing. And while some countries have been aggressively promoting electric car ownership by offering generous subsidies or by mandating specific shares of new vehicles in the future, others have offered only minor or no help. As a result, past near-term forecasts for the worldwide electrification of road transport have almost uniformly overestimated the actual share. Between 2014 and 2016, it was put as high as 8 to 11% by 2020, while the actual share was just 2.5%. And by 2019, forecasts for electrics as a share of all vehicles on the road by the year 2030 differed by an order of magnitude, while the actual sales of internal combustion vehicles may outnumber those of the electrics for more than a decade. The third category of quantitative forecasts is the one that merits a closer look, because in retrospect, many of them have not only failed to capture at least a proper order of magnitude, but their claims and conclusions have turned out to be completely at odds with what actually happened. Remarkably, this is not only true of well-known historical prophecies ranging from the Bible to Nostradamus. Many modern prophets have not done much better. Yet with the rise of ubiquitous computing, their ranks have swelled. And with the insatiable demand from the media for new bad news, their predictions and scenarios receive unprecedented distribution and increasingly global attention. Failed predictions. Given the abundance of failed forecasts, their systematic recounting, be it by subject, decade, or region, would be tedious. Listeners of a certain age will recall that by now we should have relied completely, or at least largely, on nuclear electricity, that Concorde was to be just a prelude to ubiquitous supersonic intercontinental flights, and that the Y2K glitch should have shut down all computing on January 1, 2000. But a combination of quick references to some well-known cases and brief explanations of some surprisingly little-appreciated failures provides a useful reality check, and there is no reason to assume that such misses will become less common. Moving from relatively simple pencil-and-paper forecasts to complex computerized scenarios makes it easier to perform the requisite calculations and to produce different scenarios. But it does not eliminate the inevitable perils of making assumptions. Just the opposite. More complex models combining the interactions of economic, social, technical, and environmental factors require more assumptions and open the way for greater errors. An obvious place to start when recounting some of the now classic forecasting failures is to look at the intellectual duel between cornucopians and catastrophists. Concerns about runaway populations surpassing available means of sustenance voiced during the 1960s could be traced to the record, and at that time still rising, rates of global population growth. For millennia, global population growth was a small fraction of a percent. It rose above 0.5% only during the 1770s, above 1% by the mid-1920s, but by the late 1950s it was close to 2% and still accelerating. Inevitably, many people took notice, in both professional and popular publications, and in 1960, Science, America's premier science periodical, succumbed to the worries about unrestrained population growth and published an absurd calculation, claiming that the continuation of the historic rate of increase would result in infinitely rapid growth of the global population by November the 13th, 2026. This outcome, humanity growing at infinite speed, takes some imagination, but many less extreme, although still catastrophist, predictions help to create and mobilize the modern environmental movement. But there was no need to fear runaway populations. Catastrophists ignored a simple fact that no form of very rapid growth can go on forever on a finite planet. Doomsday 2026 was obvious nonsense. Before the 1960s ended, global population growth reached its peak at about 2.1% per year, and that peak was followed by fairly rapid decline. By the year 2000, the global rate was 1.32%, and by 2019, it was just 1.08%. The halving of the relative growth rate in 50 years and the subsequent decline of the absolute growth rate, it peaked at about 93 million a year in 1987, declined to about 80 million by 2020, changed the outlook so fundamentally that sometime during the early 2020s, the world's population will cross a significant demographic milestone, as half of it will be living in countries whose total fertility rate is below the replacement level. This new reality immediately invites new catastrophic calculations. If this trend of falling fertility were to continue, when will the global population stop growing? And then, inevitably, when will the last Homo sapiens die? And a young catastrophist could speculate again about how many millions of people will die of hunger during the 2080s, not because of runaway growth, but because as populations age and shrink everywhere, there will not be, even after intensive robotization, enough people of working age to feed humanity. End-of-the-world prophecies concerning resource scarcity have not been limited to food. Running out of mineral resources has been another favourite subject of catastrophic visions, and the future of crude oil, the most important energy source of 20th century civilization, has been a favourite topic of dystopic prophecies. Forecasts of imminent peak oil extraction go back to the 1920s, but they reached new heights of existential fear-mongering during the 1990s, and the first decade of the 21st century. Some committed members of the peak oil cult believed that declining oil extraction would not only bring about the collapse of modern economies, but that it would return humanity to a lifestyle far below its pre-industrial levels, all the way to that of Paleolithic foragers, to hominins who lived in East Africa 2 million years ago. And what has actually happened? Catastrophists have always had a hard time imagining that human ingenuity can meet future food, energy, and material needs. But during the past 3 generations, we have done so despite a tripling of the global population since 1950. Instead of megadeaths, the share of undernourished people in low-income countries has been steadily declining, from about 40% during the 1960s to only about 11% by 2019. An average daily per capita food supply in China, the world's most populous nation, is now about 15% higher than in Japan. Instead of desperate fertilizer shortfalls, the application of nitrogenous fertilizers has increased more than 2.5 times since 1975, and the global harvest of staple cereal crops is now about 2.2 times larger. As for crude oil, its total extraction rose by 2/3 between 1995 and 2019. And at the end of that year, its pre-COVID-19 price, in constant monies, was lower than it was in 2009. Catastrophists are wrong, time after time. And techno-optimists, who promise endless near-miraculous solutions, must reckon with a similarly poor record. One of the best-known, and embarrassingly well-documented, failures has been the belief in the all-encompassing power of nuclear fission. Many people appreciate that the partial success achieved by nuclear generation – it produced about 10% of the world's electricity in 2019, with shares at 20% in the US and exceptionally about 72% in France – is just a fraction of what was widely expected before 1980. At that time, leading scientists and large companies not only thought that nuclear fission would eliminate all other forms of electricity generation, they also believed that the original reactors would be largely displaced by fast breeders, able to produce temporarily more energy than they consumed. The nuclear promise went far beyond electricity generation, and some astonishingly dubious ideas were tested or expensively investigated. Which decision was more irrational and more doomed from the very start? The pursuit of nuclear-powered flight or natural gas production assisted by nuclear explosions? Designing a small nuclear reactor that could power submarines was one thing. Making it light enough to be airborne turned out to be an insurmountable challenge, but one that was abandoned only in 1961 after spending billions of dollars on this hopeless task. No plane powered by nuclear fission ever took off, but several nuclear bombs were detonated in the quest for expanded natural gas production. A 29-kiloton bomb, more than twice as powerful as the one dropped on Hiroshima, was detonated in December 1967 at a depth of about 1.2 kilometers in New Mexico, codenamed Project Gas Buggy. In September 1969 came a 40-kiloton bomb in Colorado. In 1973, 3 33-kiloton bombs, also in Colorado, and the US Atomic Energy Commission anticipated future detonations of 40 to 50 bombs a year. There were also plans for such activities as using nuclear explosives to carve out new harbors and using nuclear reactors to power spaceflight. Little has changed half a century later. Frightening prophecies and utterly unrealistic promises abound. The latest burst of intensified catastrophism has been focused on environmental degradation in general and on concerns about global climate change in particular. Journalists and activists write about climate apocalypse now, issuing final warnings. In the future, areas best suited for human habitation will shrink. Large areas of the Earth are to become uninhabitable soon. Climate migration will reshape America and the world. Average global income will decline substantially. Some prophecies claim that we might only have about a decade left to avert a global catastrophe. And in January 2020, Greta Thunberg went as far as to specify just 8 years. Just a few months later, the president of the UN's General Assembly gave us 11 years to avert a complete social collapse, whereupon the planet will be simultaneously burning, suffering unquenchable summer-long fires, and inundated with water via a rapid sea level rise. But nihil nohi sub sole. In 1989, another high UN official said that governments have a 10-year window of opportunity to solve the greenhouse effect before it goes beyond human control. Which means that by now, we must be quite beyond the beyond, and that our very existence might be only a matter of Borgesian imagination. I am convinced that we could do without this continuing flood of never less than worrisome and too often quite frightening predictions. How helpful is it to be told every day that the world is coming to an end in 2050 or even 2030? Such predictably repetitive prophecies, however well-meant and however passionately presented, do not offer any practical advice about the deployment of the best possible technical solutions, about the most effective ways of legally binding global cooperation, or about tackling the difficult challenge of convincing populations of the need for significant expenditures whose benefits will not be seen for decades to come. And they are, of course, quite unnecessary, according to those who argue that a sustainable future is within our grasp. But the catastrophists have a long history of raising false alarms, who title their writings Apocalypse Not and Apocalypse Never, and, in the starkest contradistinction to civilization's supposedly rapidly approaching final curtain, even go as far, as already noted, as seeing a not-too-distant singularity. Why should we fear anything, be it environmental, social, or economic threats, when by 2045, or perhaps even by 2030, our understanding, or rather the intelligence unleashed by the machines we will have created, will know no bounds, and hence any problem will become immeasurably less than trivial? Compared to this promise, any other recent specific and intemperate claim, from salvation through nanotechnology to fashioning new synthetic forms of life, appears trite. What will happen? An imminent near-infernal perdition or speed-of-light godlike omnipotence? Based on the revealed delusions of past prophecies, neither. We do not have a civilization envisioned in the early 1970s, one of worsening planetary hunger, or one energized by cost-free nuclear fission. And a generation from now, we will not be either at the end of our evolutionary path or have a civilization transformed by singularity. We will still be around during the 2030s, albeit without the unimaginable benefits of speed-of-light intelligence, and we will still be trying to do the impossible, to make long-range forecasts. That is bound to bring more embarrassments and more ridiculous predictions, as well as more surprises caused by unanticipated events. Extremes are fairly easy to envisage. Anticipating realities that will arise from combinations of inertial developments and unpredictable discontinuities remains an elusive quest. No amount of modelling will eliminate that, and our long-range predictions will continue to err. This is not a contradiction, not a forecast to dismiss future forecasts, just a highly probable, if not inevitable, conclusion based on the unforeseeable interplay of the inherent inertia of complex systems, with their embedded constants and long-term imperatives on one hand, and sudden discontinuities and surprises, be they technical, the rise of consumer electronics, possible breakthroughs in electricity storage, or social, the collapse of the USSR, another much more virulent pandemic, on the other. What makes all forecasts even harder is that now the key transformations have to unfold on enormous scales. Inertia, scale, and mass. New departures, new solutions, and new achievements are always with us. We are a very inquisitive species, with a remarkable long-term record of adaptation and with even more remarkable recent accomplishments in making the lives of most of the world's population healthier, richer, safer, and longer. Still, fundamental constraints also persist. We have changed some of them through our ingenuity, but such adjustments have their own limits. For example, we cannot eliminate the need for land, water, and nutrients in food production. As we have seen, higher yields reduce the demand for farmland, and further reductions are possible if we succeed in the further closing of yield gaps, the differences between yield potential and actual harvests. These gaps remain substantial. Even in countries that practice intensive crop cultivation, the high use of fertilizers, irrigation, the yields could go up 20 to 25% above the recent average for US corn and 30 to 40% for Chinese rice, And because of its still very low average productivity, they could be 2 to 4 times as high in sub-Saharan Africa. In the case of high-yielding and already optimized agricultures, the resulting reduction of cropped land could be achieved with relatively small additional demands for fertilizer and irrigation. In contrast, Africa will demand substantial increases in average macronutrient applications and in the extension of irrigation. As in so many other instances, relative gains in future performance within biological limits should not be mistaken for an absolute decoupling of output and input variables as long as the world's population continues to grow and as long as it demands better nutrition. In this regard, media reports about landless urban agriculture, hydroponic cultivation in high-rises are particularly devoid of any real understanding of global food demand. Such high-input operations can produce leafy greens, lettuces, basil, and some vegetables, tomatoes, peppers, whose nutritional value is almost solely in their vitamin C content and roughage. Most assuredly, hydroponic cultivation under constant lights could not be deployed to produce more than 3 billion tons of cereal and leguminous grains, whose high carbohydrate content and relatively high protein and lipid supply are required to feed nearly 8, soon to be 10 billion people. The inertia of large complex systems is due to their basic energetic and material demands, as well as the scale of their operations. Demands for energy and materials are constantly affected by the quest for higher efficiencies and for optimized production processes. But efficiency improvements and relative dematerialization have their physical limits, and advantages brought by new alternatives will have offsetting costs. Examples of such realities abound. Turning, once again, to two fundamental inputs, the theoretical minimum of primary energy needed to produce steel, combining blast furnace and basic oxygen furnace demands, is about 18 gigajoules per ton of hot metal, and ammonia cannot be synthesized from its elements with less than about 21 gigajoules per ton. One possible solution is to replace steel with aluminium. This lowers the mass of a specific design, but primary aluminium requires 5 to 6 times more energy to produce than primary steel, and it cannot be used in many applications that require steel's much greater strength. The most radical way to cut energy costs and the environmental impact of nitrogen fertilizers is to reduce how much is used. That option is available to affluent countries with their excessive food supply and waste, but hundreds of millions of stunted children, mostly in Africa, need to drink more milk and eat more meat, and that protein can come only from substantially increasing the amount of nitrogen they use in cropping. Just to drive this conclusion home, annual applications of fertilizers average about 160 kilograms per hectare of agricultural land in the EU and less than 20 kilograms in Ethiopia. An order of magnitude difference illustrating the huge development gap that is so often ignored in appraisals of global needs. And in a civilization where production of essential commodities now serves nearly 8 billion people, any departure from established practices also runs repeatedly into the constraints of scale. As we've already heard in Chapter 3, fundamental material requirements are now measured in billions and hundreds of millions of tons per year. This makes it impossible either to substitute such masses for entirely different commodities, what would take the place of more than 4 billion tons of cement or nearly 2 billion tons of steel, or to make a rapid, years rather than decades, transition to entirely new ways of producing these essential inputs. This inevitable inertia of mass-scale dependencies can eventually be overcome. Recall that before 1920, we had to devote a quarter of American farmland to feed crops for horses and mules. But many past examples of rapid shifts are not good guides for deriving plausible time spans for any future accomplishments. Past transitions may have been relatively fast because the magnitudes involved were comparatively small. By 1900, the world's primary energy use was roughly split between traditional biomass and fossil fuels dominated by coal, and all fossil fuels supplied an equivalent of only about 1 billion tons of coal. By the year 2020, the net global supply of fossil fuels was an order of magnitude higher than the total primary energy supply in 1900. And although our technical means are now in so many ways superior, the pace of the new transition, decarbonisation, has been slower than the pace of displacing traditional biomass by fossil fuels. Even though the supply of new renewables, wind, solar, new biofuels, rose impressively, about 50-fold during the first 20 years of the 21st century, the world's dependence on fossil carbon declined only marginally from 87% to 85% of the total supply, and most of that small relative decline was attributable to expanded hydroelectricity generation, an old form of renewable energy. Because the total energy demand was an order of magnitude lower in 1920 than it was in 2020, it was much easier to displace wood by coal in the early 20th century than it is to displace fossil fuels by new renewables, that is, to decarbonise, in the early 21st century. As a result, even a tripling or quadrupling of the recent pace of decarbonisation would still leave fossil carbon dominant by 2050. A category mistake, erroneously assigning to something a quality or action that is properly attributable only to things of another category, is behind the frequent but deeply mistaken conclusion that in this new, electronically enabled world, everything can and will move much faster. Information and connections do so, and so does the adoption of new personal gadgets, but existential imperatives do not belong to the category of microprocessors and mobile phones. Securing the sufficient delivery of water, growing and processing crops, feeding and slaughtering animals, producing and converting enormous quantities of primary energies, and extracting and altering raw materials to fit a myriad of uses are endeavours whose scales, required to meet the demand of billions of consumers, and infrastructures that enable the production and distribution of these irreplaceable needs, belong to categories that are quite distinct from making a new social media profile or buying a more expensive smartphone. Moreover, many techniques that enable these new advances are hardly new. Many people smitten by the thinness of the latest smartphone and by its ability to process information are aware that many fundamental processes that make their mass ownership possible are fairly long in the tooth. Very pure silicon is the basis of all microprocessors, including those that run all modern electronic devices, from the largest supercomputers to the smallest mobile phone. And Jan Czochralski discovered how to grow single silicon crystals in 1915. Large numbers of transistors are built into silicon, and Julius Edgar Lilienfeld patented the first field effect transistor in 1925. And, as already detailed, integrated circuits were born in 1958 to 1959 and microprocessors in 1971. Most of the electricity that energizes all electronic gadgets is generated by steam turbines, machines invented by Charles A. Parsons in 1884, or by gas turbines, with the first one commercially deployed in 1938. While it has been possible to replace a billion landlines by mobile phones within a generation, it will not be possible to replace terawatts of power installed in steam and gas turbines by photovoltaic cells or wind turbines within a similar time span. Mobiles, as complex as they are just small devices at the apex of an enormous pyramid of an industry that generates, transforms, and transmits electricity, and that requires mass-scale infrastructure to build, rebuild, and maintain. These realities help to explain why the fundamentals of our lives will not change drastically in the coming 20 to 30 years, despite the near constant flood of claims about superior innovations ranging from solar cells to lithium-ion batteries, from the 3D printing of everything, from microparts to entire houses, to bacteria able to synthesize gasoline. Steel, cement, ammonia, and plastics will endure as the four material pillars of civilization. A major share of the world's transportation will be still energized by refined liquid fuels. Automotive gasoline and diesel, aviation kerosene and diesel and fuel oil for shipping. Grain fields will be cultivated by tractors pulling ploughs, harrows, seeders and fertilizer applicators and harvested by combines spilling the grains into trucks. High-rise apartments will not be printed on site by gargantuan machines, and should we soon have another pandemic, then the role of the much-touted artificial intelligence will most likely be as underwhelming as it was during the 2020 SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. Ignorance, persistence, and humility. COVID-19 has provided a perfect and costly global reminder of our limited capacity to chart our futures, and that too will not, cannot, change in any dramatic way during the coming generation. The latest pandemic came after a decade that was suffused with adulatory praise of unprecedented and supposedly truly disruptive scientific and technical advances. Chief among them have been the anticipation of imminent deployments of the miraculous powers of artificial intelligence and neural learning networks, singularity light, one might say, and genome editing that will make it possible to engineer life forms at will. Nothing sums up better the excessive nature of these claims than the title of a 2017 bestseller, Yuval Noah Harari's Homo Deus. And if more evidence is required, then COVID-19 exposed the emptiness of any notions of our supposed godlike capacity to control our fate. None of those much-touted capabilities was of any use in preventing the rise or controlling the diffusion of those viral RNA strands. The best we could do is what the residents of Italian towns did in the Middle Ages. Stay away from others, stay inside for 40 days, isolate for 40 giorni. Vaccines came relatively early, but they do not cure the stricken, and they do not prevent the next pandemic. And so we must pray that the next event, because there is always a next one, will come only after decades of relatively uneventful seasonal viral epidemics, rather than in just a few years and in a much more virulent form. COVID-19's impact in rich countries in general, and in the United States in particular, also illustrates how misplaced some of our highly touted and very expensive future-forming endeavours have been. Foremost among these have been the renewed steps towards manned spaceflight, and particularly the sci-fi-type goal of missions to Mars. Trying to move toward personalised medicine, diagnosis and treatment tailored to individual patients based on their specific risk or response to a disease, with The Economist running a special report on this topic on March 12, 2020, just as COVID-19 began to sweep through Europe and North America, filling urban hospitals with oxygen-deprived people, and being preoccupied with ever-faster connectivity, with endless hype surrounding the benefits of 5G networks. How irrelevant are all of these quests, while, as the cliché goes, the only remaining superpower could not provide its nurses and doctors with enough simple personal protection equipment, including such low-tech items as gloves, masks, caps, and gowns. Consequently, the US had to pay exorbitant prices to China, the country where the brilliant architects of globalization concentrated nearly all of the manufacturing of these essential items in order to secure airlifts of inadequate amounts of protective equipment just to prevent hospital closures in the midst of a pandemic. The country that spends more than $500 billion every year on its military, more than all of its potential adversaries put together, was unprepared for an event that was absolutely certain to occur, and it did not have enough basic medical supplies. Investment in domestic production worth a few $100 million could have significantly reduced the economic losses of COVID-19 measured in the trillions. Nor did Europe distinguish itself. Member states engaged in competition for jumbo airlifts of protective plastic from China. The vaunted absence of borders was quickly transformed into fortress arrangements. The ever closer union failed to deliver any union-wide coordinated response. And during the first 6 months of the pandemic, four of the continent's five most populous nations, UK, France, Italy and Spain, and two of its richest countries, Switzerland and Luxembourg, whose health systems were for decades praised as paragons of excellence, recorded some of the world's highest pandemic mortalities. Crises expose realities and strip away obfuscation and misdirection. The response of the affluent world to COVID-19 deserves a single ironic comment. Homo Deus, indeed. At the same time, the rich world's reaction to COVID-19 illustrates our perennially unrealistic attitude to fundamental realities caused by forgetting even traumatic experiences. As the COVID-19 pandemic began to unfold, I did not expect that this challenge would be set within proper historical perspectives. What else is to be expected in a society dominated by tweets? And I was not surprised by references to the 1918-1919 influenza that caused the highest, albeit globally highly uncertain, number of pandemic deaths in modern history. But, as I already noted in the chapter on risk, since that time we have lived through three notable, and much better understood, episodes, and they have not left any deep imprint in our collective memory. I already suggested some explanations, but others are plausible. Was the toll of more than a million deaths in 1957 to 1958, in most countries taking place incrementally over 6 to 9 months, seen through the prism of much larger Second World War losses that were still clear in the memory of all adults? Or has our collective perception changed to such an extent that we cannot accept the fact that temporary excessive mortality will always be beyond our control? Or is it simply the fact that forgetting is an essential complement of remembering, be it on a personal or collective level, and that this too will not change, as we will be, again and again, surprised by what should have been expected? Persistence is as important as forgetting. Despite the promises of new beginnings and bold departures, old patterns and old approaches soon resurface to set the stage for another round of failures. I ask any readers who doubt this to check sentiments during and immediately after the great financial crisis of 2007 to 2008 and compare them with the post-crisis experience. Who has been found responsible for this systemic near collapse of the financial order? What fundamental departures, besides enormous injections of new monies, were taken to reform questionable practices or to reduce economic inequality? Returning to the COVID-19 example, this pattern of persistence means that nobody will ever be found responsible for any of the many strategic lapses that guaranteed the mismanagement of the pandemic even before it began. Undoubtedly, some desultory hearings and a few think tank papers will produce a list of recommendations, but those will be promptly ignored, and it will make no difference to deeply ingrained habits. Did the world take any resolute steps after the pandemics of 1918 to 1919, 1958 to 1959, 1968 to 1969, and 2009? Governments will not ensure adequate provisions of needed supplies for a future pandemic, and their response will be as inconsistent, if not as incoherent, as ever. The profits of mass-scale, single-source manufacturing will not be changed for less vulnerable but more expensive decentralized production. And people will resume their constant global mingling as they return to intercontinental flights and cruises to nowhere, although it is hard to imagine a better virus incubator than a ship with 3,000 crew and 5,000 passengers, who are often mostly elderly with many pre-existing health conditions. This also means that we will need, again and again, to relearn how to reconcile ourselves to realities beyond our control. COVID-19 provides a useful reminder. The pandemic has caused the highest excessive mortality among the oldest cohorts, and as already noted, this outcome is obviously linked to our very successful efforts to extend life expectancy. I, born in 1943, have been among the tens of millions of beneficiaries of this trend, but we cannot have it both ways. Longer life expectancy will be accompanied by greater vulnerability. Not surprisingly, comorbidities of old age, ranging from fairly common hypertension and diabetes to less common forms of cancer and compromised immunity, have been the best predictors of excess viral mortality. Yet, this will not prevent us, as it did not in 1968 or 2009, taking more steps toward prolonging life expectancy and then fearing the likely consequences of this quest, seen to a lesser but still substantial extent even during seasonal influenza epidemics. Except the next time, the risk will be significantly higher because the combination of natural aging and prolongation of life will greatly increase the share of people over 65 years of age. The UN projects that share rising by about 70% by 2050, and in better-off countries, one person in four will be older than that. How will we cope in 2050 with a pandemic that might be more infectious than COVID-19, when in some countries a third of the population is in the most vulnerable category? These realities disprove any general, automatic, embedded, unavoidable ideas of progress and constant improvement that has been promoted by many techno-optimists. Neither the evolution nor the history of our species is an ever-rising arrow. There are no predictable trajectories, no definite targets. The steadily accumulating mass of our understanding and the ability to control a growing number of variables that affect our lives, ranging from food production that is sufficient to feed the world's entire population to highly effective inoculation that prevents previously dangerous infectious diseases, has lowered the overall risk of living, but it has not made any existential perils either more predictable or more manageable. In some critical instances, our successes and our abilities to avoid the worst outcomes have been due to being prescient, vigilant, and determined to find effective fixes. Notable examples range from eliminating polio by developing effective vaccines to lowering the risks of commercial flying by building more reliable airplanes and introducing better flight control measures, from reducing food pathogens by a combination of proper food processing, refrigeration, and personal hygiene, to making childhood leukemia a largely survivable illness by chemotherapy and stem cell transplants. In other cases, we have been undoubtedly lucky. For decades, we have avoided nuclear confrontation caused by an error or accident. We have experienced both on several occasions since the 1950s, not only because of built-in safeguards, but also thanks to judgments that could have gone either way. Again, there are no clear indications that our ability to prevent failures has been uniformly increasing. Fukushima and the Boeing 737 MAX are, unfortunately, two perfect examples of these failures, both with large-scale and lasting consequences. Why did the Tokyo Power Company lose three reactors at its Fukushima Daiichi plant when an earthquake and tsunami struck on March 11, 2011? After all, just about 15 kilometers south of the plant, on the same Pacific shore hit by the same tsunami, its twin, Fukushima Daini, did not suffer the slightest damage. Repercussions of the Fukushima Daiichi failure have ranged from Japan being deprived of 30% of its electricity generating capacity to Germany's decision to shut down all reactors by 2021, and above all, to an even deeper public distrust of fission as a source of energy. And why has Boeing, the company that risked everything on developing the 747 in 1966 and that went on to introduce successful new families of jetliners, now up to 787s, insisted on constantly enlarging the 737, introduced in 1964, a dubious quest that led to two catastrophic accidents? Why was the plane not grounded, either by Boeing or by the Federal Aviation Administration, immediately after the first fatal accident? Again, the consequences of these failures have been profound. First, the temporary grounding of the entire 737 MAX fleet starting in March 2019, then the cessation of the plane's production and cancellation of new orders. In the long run, this will affect Boeing's ability to introduce a much-needed new design to replace its aging 757, with all these consequences magnified by the COVID-induced collapse of international flying. Given the number of new designs, structures, and complex processes and interactive operations, the failures illustrated by Fukushima and the Boeing 737 MAX cannot be prevented, and the coming decades will see other and unpredictable manifestations of this reality. The future is a replay of the past, a combination of admirable advances and unavoidable setbacks. But there is something new as we look ahead, that unmistakable increasing, albeit not unanimous, conviction that of all the risks we face, global climate change is the one that needs to be tackled most urgently and effectively. And there are two fundamental reasons why this combination of speed and efficacy will be much harder to realise than is generally assumed. Unprecedented commitments, delayed rewards. Dealing with this challenge will, for the first time in history, require a truly global, as well as very substantial and prolonged, commitment. To conclude that we will be able to achieve decarbonisation anytime soon, effectively and on the required scales, runs against all past evidence. The UN's first climate conference took place in 1992, and in the intervening decades, we have had a series of global meetings and countless assessments and studies, but nearly three decades later, there is still no binding international agreement to moderate the annual emissions of greenhouse gases and no prospect for its early adoption. In order to be effective, this would have to entail nothing less than a global accord. This does not mean that 200 nations must sign on dotted lines. The combined emissions of about 50 small nations add up to less than the likely error in quantifying the emissions of just the top five greenhouse gas producers. No real progress can be achieved until at least these top five countries, now responsible for 80% of all emissions, agree to clear and binding commitments. But we are nowhere close to embarking on such a concerted global action. Recall that the much-praised Paris Accord had no specific emission reduction targets for the world's largest emitters, and that its non-binding pledges would not mitigate anything. They would result in 50% higher emissions by 2050. And that its non-binding pledges would not mitigate anything. They would result in 50% higher emissions by 2050. Moreover, any effective commitments will be expensive. They will have to last for at least two generations in order to bring the desired outcome of much reduced, if not totally eliminated, greenhouse gas emissions and even drastic reductions going well beyond anything that could be realistically envisaged will not show any convincing benefits for decades. This raises the extraordinarily difficult problem of intergenerational justice, that is, our never-failing propensity to discount the future. We value now more than later, and we price it accordingly. An avid 30-year-old mountaineer is willing to pay some $60,000 for permits, gear, Sherpas, oxygen, and other expenses to climb Mount Everest next year. But he would demand a steep discount, reflecting such obvious intervening uncertainties as his health, the stability of future Nepali governments, the probability of major Himalayan earthquakes preventing any expeditions, and the likelihood of shutting down the access for buying a promise to scale the mountain in 2050. This universal inclination to discount the future matters greatly when contemplating such complex and costly undertakings as pricing carbon in order to mitigate global climate change, because there would be no discernible economic benefits for the generation of people that would launch the expensive quest. Because greenhouse gases remain in the atmosphere for long periods of time after they have been emitted, for CO2 up to 200 years, even very strong mitigation efforts would not give a clear signal of success, the first significant decline of global mean surface temperature for several decades. Obviously, a temperature rise that would continue for 25 to 35 years after the launching of a massive global decarbonisation effort would present a major challenge for enacting and pursuing such drastic measures. But because there are currently no globally binding commitments that could see any widespread adoption of such steps within a few years, both the break-even point and the onset of measurable temperature declines advance even further into the future. A commonly used climate economy model indicates the break-even year, when the optimal policy would begin to produce net economic benefit, for mitigation efforts launched in the early 2020s would be only around 2080. Should average global life expectancy, about 72 years in 2020, remain the same, then the generation born near the middle of the 21st century would be the first to experience cumulative economic net benefit from climate change mitigation policy. Are the young citizens of affluent countries ready to put these distant benefits ahead of their more immediate gains? Are they willing to sustain this course for more than half a century, even as the low-income countries with growing populations continue, as a matter of basic survival, to expand their reliance on fossil carbon? And are the people, now in their 40s and 50s, ready to join them in order to bring about rewards they will never see? The latest pandemic has served as yet another reminder that one of the best ways to minimize the impact of increasingly global challenges is to have a set of priorities and basic measures for how to deal with them. But the pandemic, with its incoherent and non-uniform inter- and intranational measures, has also shown how difficult it would be to codify such principles and to follow such guidelines. Failures revealed during crises offer costly and convincing illustrations of our recurrent inability to get the basics right, to take care of the fundamentals. By now, listeners of this audiobook will appreciate that this short list must include the security of basic food, energy, and material supply, all provided with the least possible impact on the environment, and all done while realistically appraising the steps that we can take to minimize the extent of future global warming. That is a daunting prospect, and nobody can be sure that we will succeed or that we will fail. Being agnostic about the distant future means being honest. We have to admit the limits of our understanding, approach all planetary challenges with humility, and recognize that advances, setbacks, and failures will all continue to be a part of our evolution, and that there can be no assurance of, however defined, ultimate success, no arrival at any singularity. But as long as we use our accumulated understanding with determination and perseverance, there will also not be an early end of days. The future will emerge from our accomplishments and failures, and while we might be clever and lucky enough to foresee some of its forms and features, the whole remains elusive even when looking just a generation ahead. The first draft of this closing chapter was written on May 8, 2020, the 75th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in Europe. Let's imagine a scenario in which on that spring day in the mid-20th century, a small group of people embodying all extant knowledge of the time sat down to discuss and predict the state of the world in 2020. Being aware of the latest breakthroughs in areas ranging from engineering, gas turbines, nuclear reactors, electronic computers, rockets, to life sciences, antibiotics, pesticides, herbicides, vaccines, they could correctly foresee many rising trajectories, ranging from mass automobilization and affordable intercontinental flight to electronic computing, and from rising crop yields to significant gains in life expectancy. But they would not be able to describe the advances, complexities, and nuances of the world that we have created by our accomplishments and failures during the intervening 75 years. To stress this impossibility, just think in national terms. In 1945, Japan's wooden cities were, save for Kyoto, essentially levelled. Europe was in post-war disarray, shortly to be split by the Cold War. The USSR was victorious, but at an enormous cost, and it remained under Stalin's ruthless rule. The US emerged as an unprecedented superpower, generating about half of the world's economic product. China was desperately poor, and again on the brink of civil war. Who could have traced their specific trajectories of rise and fall? Japan. Of new prosperity, new problems, new unity, and new disunity? Europe. Of aggressive confidence, we will bury you, and demise, USSR. Of blunders, defeats, wasted accomplishments, and unrealized possibilities, USA. And of suffering, the world's worst famine, slow recovery, and steep ascent to questionable heights, China. Nobody in 1945 could have predicted a world with more than 5 billion additional people that is also better fed than at any time in history, even as it keeps wasting an indefensibly high share of all the food it grows. Nor did anybody foresee a world that relegated a number of infectious diseases, most notably polio everywhere and tuberculosis in affluent nations, to historical footnotes, but that cannot keep economic inequality from widening even in the richest countries. A world that is at once much cleaner and much healthier, yet also more polluted in new ways, from plastic in the ocean to heavy metals in soils, and, due to the ongoing biospheric degradation, also more precarious. Or a world suffused in instant and essentially free information that comes at the price of massively disseminated misinformation, lies, and reprehensible claims. A lifetime later, There is no reason to believe that we are in a better position to foresee the extent of coming technical innovations, unless, of course, you are a believer in near-imminent singularity, the events that will shape the fortunes of nations and the decisions, or their regrettable absence, that will determine the fate of our civilization during the next 75 years. Despite the recent preoccupation with the eventual impacts of global warming and with the need for rapid decarbonization, few uncertain outcomes will be as important in determining our future as the trajectory of the global population during the remainder of the 21st century. Extreme forecasts offer very different futures. Will the global population surpass 15 billion by 2100, nearly twice as many as in 2020, or will it shrink to 4.8 billion, losing more than half of today's total, with China shrinking by 48%? As expected, the medium variants of these forecasts are not that far apart, 8.8 and 10.9 billion. Still, being 2 billion people apart is not an inconsequential gap, and these comparisons show how even basic population forecasts veer apart after just a single generation. All too obviously, even when forecasts go only as far as today's life expectancy in affluent countries, the implications of their extreme values shape two very different economic, social, and environmental trajectories. And as the first and second drafts of this book were written during the first and second waves of COVID-19, it is quite realistic to ask if the new pandemics we will face throughout the remainder of the 21st century, given their post-1900 frequency, 1918, 1957, 1968, 2009, 2020, we can expect at least two or three such events before 2100, will be similar, much weaker, or far more virulent than the 2020 event. Living with these fundamental uncertainties remains the essence of the human condition, and it limits our ability to act with foresight. As I noted in the opening chapter, I am not a pessimist or an optimist, I am a scientist. There is no agenda in understanding how the world really works. A realistic grasp of our past, present, and uncertain future is the best foundation for approaching the unknowable expanse of time before us. While we cannot be specific, we know that the most likely prospect is a mixture of progress and setbacks, of seemingly insurmountable difficulties and near miraculous advances. The future, as ever, is not predetermined. Its outcome depends on our actions.